Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hey everyone, and welcome to All Together, the Family Science Insights podcast, produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We are champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week, we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with the expert knowledge of professionals in the field. I'm your host, Dina Sargent. Let's get started. Hey guys, and welcome back to another episode. Domestic violence is a very serious issue for all involved, especially the children that are involved. They are known as the hidden victims of this issue today. Joining me on the show today is childhood trauma consultant, three-time best-selling author, and child welfare advocate, Beth Tyson. Thank you so much for joining me, Beth.
Thank you for having me today. I'm so honored to be here.
Now, given the background and given the path, the career path that you've taken, what really got you wanting to talk about this role and sort of being a bit more of an advocate for children going through this serious topic?
Yes, sure. So I was a trauma therapist for children and families who were either foster families, kinship families, which is oftentimes grandparents raising their grandchildren, or adoptive families who were in crisis. And what I found was that when I provided lots of psychoeducation to the parents about childhood trauma and how to help them cope and how to help the children cope with that trauma, I saw a major shift in the progress in the families. And so while I was there to be the therapist for the child primarily, I found that I made such an impact working with the families, working with the adults that were raising the children and changing their lens of, this child doesn't like me, or this child is just doing this on purpose, to, these behaviors are our trauma response, was able to really make a lot of progress and keep families together. So once I had my own daughter, decided that I wasn't quite ready to go back to doing such intense, heavy work with, you know, people who had experienced abuse and neglect and loss, and said, well, what else could I do? So I decided to follow a dream I had to publish a children's book for kinship families, which are, like I said, relatives who are raising other relatives' children. And when I did that, I began to educate the public about this issue and how they could support children who are suffering from trauma. And it organically grew into a business where now I travel around the country and I speak internationally on childhood trauma and how to help children heal after extreme adversity. So I train and educate mostly adults at this point, but it was really born out of the idea that, you know, children don't heal in a vacuum. Like, yes, therapy is really good for children, but it's the environment they're in that needs to shift and change in order for the healing to occur. So I felt that I just had a message for a wider audience than just like one-on-one therapy, and wanted to bring it to more people.
No, that's amazing. And I love the idea of just finding another way to advocate for it rather than dealing with it directly as well. Like, it's not something that anyone, I feel, could really just walk away from once they sort of dealt with it. So I definitely applaud you for staying in that area and wanting to find a different way to do that.
Right. It was about finding a good balance for me. And I feel like I have now, where I'm still using the knowledge, I'm still advocating, I'm still helping children, but I'm not in direct relationship with them at, you know, week by week by week. So I'm not taking on a lot of that vicarious drama, and I'm able to be strong for my own family now. So,
you know, that's amazing. And speaking of your own family as well, I was reading a little bit about your bio that was sent over to us, and I love the idea of what you do in your own free time as well, sort of with your family and going either skiing or doing all those other things. What is the best part about sort of doing all those activities together as a family?
Yeah, I think we spend a lot of family time together. We're fortunate that we're able to have flexible work schedules and spend a lot of time with our daughter when she's not at school. And we find that we have the most fun and the most bonding time doing activities together. My daughter's very physically active. And so connecting with her in that environment, it's always a positive experience. And so skiing is something I love, something my husband loves to do, and now she loves to do it. And so it's about having more positive interactions as a family for me, because that's what helps contribute to long-term mental and emotional wellness. Is the more positive interactions you're having in your family, the less time you have to have negative interactions, right? So you just want to try and tip those scales. And of course, it's not always that way. We have hard days and you know, arguments and struggles like any family. But, you know, I never aim to be 100% perfect as a parent. It's pretty much not possible. But if I can at least get, you know, 60-40, you know, that's a win for me. So.
No, definitely. And yeah, so that's the best part about reading your bio, is seeing all the stuff that you do. I mean, a lot of people, when we come into the show, we talk the professional side, but also seeing how they balance their own work and family life is, I think, just as important on the show.
Definitely.
So before we dive in and before we get deep into what we're talking about today, I love to get to know some of your recommendations and some of your interests by playing our little icebreaker to start off in the question base.
Yeah. Let's do it.
So to start off with, do you have a most recent book that you're reading?
I'm reading The Glass Castle, and it's by, I think it's Jeanette Williams. I might be messing that up, and I apologize if I don't have the right author name, but I know her first name is Jeanette. And it's called The Glass Castle, and it's also a Netflix movie as well. So if you like the movies versus the books, but I recommend it. It's fascinating. Fascinating story.
Okay. Oh, perfect. Now, do you have a movie that has really resonated with you recently?
A movie. Let's see. I would say one of my favorite movies is, and this is an oldie, this is going back, but my favorite movie is called Awakenings. And it was, okay. I think it was filmed in the 80s or 90s, but I recommend people checking that one out if you're interested in psychology and mental health. Another really good, interesting movie.
Oh, perfect. No, that sounds really interesting. I love coming onto the show because there's always some great recommendations that get sent over to me that I just keep making note of and keep looking at after the show. So no, thank you for that.
Yeah.
Now, do you have a podcast that you find yourself listening to?
I love the podcast Therapy Chat. It's a trauma-informed podcast for mental health professionals, and it's super informative, lots of good information, and that's one of my favorites. It's called Therapy Chat.
Perfect. Okay. Now, do you have a famous role model that you find yourself looking up to in certain times?
Let's see, a famous role model. I've always looked up to Oprah Winfrey. I just admire her resilience and tenacity and her ability to connect with people. And she's an inspiration to me.
No, I can definitely see that she's pretty much, every time I ask that question, she's one of the famous ones that keep popping up. So
really?
Yeah, I think a lot of people really resonate with her as well.
Yeah, she's got some magic in her, that's for sure.
Yeah, especially how long she's been doing the work that she's been doing as well. It's amazing. And I think one of my favorite parts of her was when she built that school, sort of help a lot of children who don't get education get an education, which I think is very important.
Yes, definitely. She's a big advocate for children's well-being and mental health. And she co-authored a book with Dr. Bruce Perry, who's one of the foremost trauma experts in the United States. And I think that is also another reason why she really understands trauma and childhood trauma from both a lived experience and also from, you know, working closely with Dr. Perry. So I find that also very inspiring and interesting.
Yeah, no, it really is. Now, when it comes to your academic pursuit, do you have a course that has really resonated with you and sort of inspired a lot of what you're doing today?
So I would say kind of what inspired me to do this work today was I lost my mom when I was 26. She died suddenly in her sleep one night. And I was working in corporate America at that time, and it was very unfulfilling and sort of just didn't feel like the right thing for me. I definitely was not in alignment with my beliefs and my interests and my passions. And her death, of course, was traumatic for me. But as I moved through my grief and began to heal, I had like this perspective on life that I never had before her death, in that life can be really short. And when you're 26, you don't feel that way, right? You're like, you feel young and you feel like nothing bad is ever going to happen. And you kind of, you're not thinking about the long term. You're mostly living in the present a lot when you're in your 20s. And her death made me realize that life can be really cut short way too soon, and that I should go after the things that I'm really passionate about. And so I went back and got my master's degree in clinical counseling a few years after she passed away. And it was the best decision I ever made in my life. It led me here to the work that I'm doing now. And so much of my own healing happened in the process of getting my clinical degree, because you have to do all this self-exploration work to become a therapist. And you're also learning all the textbook information at the same time. So it was really very well timed in terms of my own healing. It was a big portion of it. And yeah, so that, you know, that is what brought me to it. And so a big part of my mission or cause is to bring awareness to grief and loss and the trauma that can cause, and how to work through it and sort of come out the other side. You never fully heal from a loss like that, but you learn how to live with it and still move forward. And I want to inspire other people to do the same.
Well, that's a perfect answer. And thank you so much for sharing that.
You're welcome.
And I hope that playing this game has sort of, I hope that the work that you're doing has really sort of inspired a lot of other people as well. Because I know that it's an amazing way to sort of start what you're doing.
Thank you.
And I hope that you're all warmed up for the questions that we're about to look into today, and a little bit easier to ask questions, and hope that I sort of ask questions a little bit easier today to do. For some reason, I'm a bit tongue-tied, which I have idea why, but we'll get into it. Now, when it comes to families, I know that everyone has a different answer as to what a family is and what sort of creates a family. So from your own perspective, what do you think your definition of a family is?
So the work that I do and the role that I've played has definitely widened my lens on what can be considered a family. And I think it's so important, especially for children who maybe don't have a traditional looking family, to expand their definition of what family can be. So for myself, like, I always thought of it, a family as, you know, mom, a dad, and children, and grandparents, aunts, uncles. But for a lot of the kids that I work with, they are being raised by their grandparents, or they're being raised by foster parents, or maybe they're being raised by an aunt or uncle, or a neighbor or a friend, a coach, a teacher. You know, there's all these different types of families that I work with. So, you know, to me, a family is about commitment, consistency, compassion, and love. And if a child has those things, that's family. You know, they can be family for that child. It does not have to include a blood relationship to create a family, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great answer. That's a very similar answer to what a lot of the people on the show say when it comes to family. It's that there is no, the whole idea of a blood relative family is, especially in this day and age, is not very the most common answer anymore, which is, it's surprising when you think about it. And when you think about how every situation sort of changes and how each child sort of defines it. Now,
Do you think that families still hold the same importance as it has done in the past decade?
I mean, I think it's more important. I think it's always super important for children to have family. That is the foundation of our emotional well-being. Our family is there to support us, to provide care and guide us through difficulties. And your family is everything. Now, again, it doesn't have to be a blood-related family, but the people that are there around you are your source of comfort and care. And so to me, there's nothing more important than a child having at least one committed, consistent, loving, caring adult in their lives. And there's research that backs this up, that children who have at least one committed, caring, loving adult have less long-term mental health impact from early life adversity versus those children who never sort of find at least one person who's committed to them long-term. So, you know, a family can be two people. It doesn't have to be five. It doesn't have to be 10. It can be, you know, one adult and one child, and you can still make an incredible impact on that child's life.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to domestic violence, and I know I spoke about that a little bit earlier when it comes to a lot of the overlooked impact that it has. And I know we talk about that often, saying that it does impact children, but how does domestic violence really impact a child's mental health?
Sure. Well, like I said, the family unit, however it's designed or made up, is so crucial to the well-being of a child. What it does is removes their sense of safety and trust in adults. And when a child doesn't feel safe and they don't feel as though they can trust the adults around them, that is trauma. You know, that's a type of trauma. And so when children are witnessing abuse or being abused themselves, they lose that safety and trust. And it has to be rebuilt in order for them to move through a healing process. And I never believe that we ever truly reach a healed place necessarily from some of these really terrible experiences, especially in early life. But we can move forward even though we have these losses of safety and security, if we have people in our lives that we can trust and can rebuild, sort of correct the belief systems that were set up early in life. So I think that domestic violence can rip away that safety, and then you'll start to see a child who is under threat, even if they are safe. So you'll see the trauma responses, and the trauma responses in children show up as that fight, flight, freeze. And now there's a couple of new ones they're adding on. There's the most common one they've added is a fourth one called fawn, which means that the child becomes an extreme people pleaser because they're just terrified of what might happen if they step out of line or make a mistake or get a bad grade. So they look like very productive, very well-behaved children, but they are behaving and acting that way because they're terrified of rocking the boat and something awful happening. And then, you know, the fight, flight, and freeze responses are pretty self-explanatory, but a child who feels under threat or feels insecure or unsafe, their first two reactions are either to fight. So you'll see aggression, you might see violence, you might see anger, fighting with siblings, fighting with adults. And if that's not the route they go, they might run or hide or, you know, run away to try and get away from the threat. And if neither of those work, then typically there's a freeze response that's a protective measure by the brain. It's like an animal that plays dead. You know, they're alive in there, but they don't look alive. They're frozen. They're stuck. And so children can often go into a shutdown, withdrawal from friends and family, and, you know, kind of spend a lot of time alone, not speaking or not interacting with others. And also there's dissociation, which happens where the child may lose track of time, They may not have memories of things that happened. And this can be frustrating for parents as well as teachers and other people in the child's life because they look like they might be lying or not paying attention, but they're actually unable to recall certain things because their brain is in this protective measure. So you see a lot of behavioral issues and a lot of emotional outbursts or the shutdown. And that can be really frustrating for adults if they don't understand what the child's brain and body is doing and why it's reacting the way that it is. Makes it very difficult to learn and to manage your emotions when you feel as though you're constantly under threat or that something terrible might happen to you, your sibling, your mother, your father. It's just your brain cannot possibly handle all of that stimulation in a healthy way. And so your body and brain try to protect yourself with these behaviors.
And it's really interesting because when you're talking about this, it's sort of just, it talks about a lot of different situations that a child maybe go into. And I did want to sort of define the space in where it becomes just, okay, a parent yelling and where it actually becomes sort of a sense of verbal abuse or physical abuse and when it comes to that point. So when a parent sort of like, how do you differentiate when a parent is just yelling at a child out of anger or frustration or when they're taking that a bit too much?
Right, right. Well, we know that children, they don't learn when they're being yelled at. They're not learning a lesson. They're not, there's actually no benefit really to yelling at a child. It can only do really harm. And so, you know, it really depends on the child. Like some people think that trauma is an event that happens, but that's not really an accurate way to understand trauma. Trauma is the way we respond to the event that has taken place. So for me, like I might feel very traumatized by someone yelling at me, whereas my brother might not feel very traumatized by that because of his own like innate resiliency, brain makeup, support system around him or different dynamic or relationship with the parent. So it really depends on how the child is feeling it and taking it in and responding to it. And some kids are just more vulnerable to yelling or to threats and things like that than other children. Now, of course, there gets a line, right, where it's like definitely abusive if there's name calling, if there's shaming, ridiculing, teasing, put downs, cursing at a child or swearing at a child, you know, attacking their character, telling them that they're a bad person, they're a bad kid. You know, these types of things are always harmful and considered abusive. But then, of course, you know, everyday parents also yell at their kids. I've yelled at my kid. I mean, we all lose our temper sometimes. It's really about how do we repair what we've done? And are we remorseful for what we've done? And are we able to recognize that we want to do better? And I think if you're a parent who sees your mistake and is able to repair what you've done by going back to the child and saying, listen, you know, after things have calmed down and cooled off, going back to the child and saying, I don't like how I just spoke to you a few minutes ago or yesterday or last night or whatever it is. I messed up. I should not have said that to you in that way. I know that must have scared you. I'm really trying to work on not doing that again. And, you know, here are the ways and here are the things that I'm going to do to try and not react that way next time. And sort of repairing that relationship and repairing the harm that has been done is really, really important part of any relationship. And we sometimes don't do that with children because we're either afraid to bring it back up. We think they've forgotten about it. We're like, oh, no, they're over it. They went back to playing. Our relationship seems fine. But really, we do need to go back and have those conversations with children because they will remember that. They will absolutely remember that. My dad was one who sometimes lost his temper with me. And I remember him coming into the room afterwards and apologizing. And that meant so much to me as a kid. And it's something I never forgot, even as an adult. So, you know, that's part of the process. And I think it also teaches children that we can mess up. We all mess up sometimes. And when we mess up, we need to apologize, sincerely apologize, and find ways to do better next time. But we don't have to completely shame ourselves and tear ourselves apart over it. We can, you know, recognize what we've done and try and do better next time, because we're human and we're going to make mistakes. But I think it becomes abuse when it's constant, you know, it's every day, it's, you know, frequent, at least if not every day, it's very frequent. And it involves some of these like really calloused comments or shaming and invalidating the child. Those things are always going to meet the threshold for verbal abuse of a child.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Those characteristics that you sort of mentioned a little bit earlier, when the fight, flight, freeze and fawn sort of characteristics, as a bystander looking at a parent who is yelling at a child, or what are some, or even a teacher who's sort of looking at the behaviors of the children, mm-hmm. what are some signs for those members to sort of look at if they're, if a child is sort of being a victim of domestic abuse?
Mm. Yeah. Well, there's, you know, sometimes there's obvious things like physical bruises and visual things that you can see on a child's body depending on what they're wearing. So that's always, you know, if you're seeing like, you know, two or three small dots on their upper arm, those are fingerprints. That's someone who's grabbed a child hard enough to squeeze and cause a bruise on their body. So that's, you know, a common thing. There's certain areas of the body that normally don't get bruised at certain ages. And so if you see bruises, I mean, the legs and stuff, of course, you're going to see lots of bruises and bumps on a kid's legs and potentially their arm and even their head. But like if you're seeing a bruise in like an odd place that normally wouldn't be something that a child would be hurt by, or like couldn't just fall down and have happen, it's always important to ask questions about, you know, whether they feel safe at home or is there anybody that might be harming them or hurting them. There's also, you know, self-report, like children will tell stories and they'll just start verbally explaining like things that have happened at home. So we always want to take that very seriously. But then there's other symptoms, right? They may come out behaviorally, and you can't always say for sure that it's domestic violence. It could be something else. It could be grief and loss. It could be separation. It could be divorce. It could be lots of things. The trauma responses are going to show up whether it's abuse, like physical abuse, or whether it's grief and loss, or whether it's like separation from an important family member. Like there's lots of different scenarios that could point to the fact that it's something is going on with the child. It doesn't necessarily mean it's domestic violence. So I'll go through some of those, which would be children tend to somatize their emotions, which means that they feel them in their body more acutely than adults sometimes do, because they don't always have the language to express what they are feeling, especially young children. So children who are frequently complaining of stomach aches, diarrhea, headaches, body aches, that's a typical manifestation of, you know, there might be something going on here if it's been checked medically and they can't find any other answers. So that's one thing parents want to keep an eye out for. Other things are like, you know, frequent crying, or like emotional outbursts and tantrums. Anything that lasts beyond 20 minutes for a tantrum is usually outside the norm. Of course, there's going to be one-offs. There's going to be times when that happens. But if it's happening frequently and you're having tantrums that are longer than 20 minutes, you definitely want to seek out some additional evaluation or support from your pediatrician or from an occupational therapist, depending on what, I don't know how like your systems sort of work in Australia, but here in the US, like, you know, we're always told to reach out to our pediatrician if we're noticing any emotional or behavioral issues. You might see defiance and opposition. So like children who won't follow rules, won't do what they're told, won't listen, won't follow directions. That's another symptom, because they're trying to gain control and they're trying to gain control because they're scared that if they don't control things, everything will fall apart, or they may be hurt or harmed. And so they've lost so much control, right? In a lot of these situations, they have very little control over their lives and circumstances and the things that happen to them. And so they're trying to gain it in any way they can possibly gain it. And so that can look like a child who's uncooperative, like extremely uncooperative. All children are somewhat uncooperative, right? But it's like, is this falling on the extreme end of things? It's a spectrum. Those are some of the main things. Also regression. So a child who is acting younger than their developmental age. So if a child was potty trained and now all of a sudden they're wetting the bed again, or if a child was learning how to talk and all of a sudden they've stopped talking, or, you know, so if you're seeing like a regression in their development, that can be another sign that trauma is taking place. So those are some of the major red flags that we see. And of course, if you ever have any concerns, you want to reach out to your pediatrician for that kind of help and direction.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So especially when when sort of being that bystander, sort of seeing it, what is the best way to sort of handle? Because I know in a lot of situations, if a child is sort of like being pulled on the street or sort of like being yanked in certain directions or them sort of fighting back a little bit, not everyone is sort of wanting to just walk up and sort of deal with that situation. But someone who's seeing that happen, what is the best way that you would recommend a bystander sort of taking a little bit of a stand?
I mean, that's really tough. That's a really tough question. I don't even know what I would do necessarily in that situation. But I think, like, obviously if it's a safety issue, if a child is being harmed, you could call like the police or call 911. There is, in the United States anyway, there's like a crisis line that a family member could call or a parent could call if they felt like their spouse or somebody else was harming a child. But if you're just a bystander, that's a really tough situation because, like, you don't know their name. You don't know their contact information to call, like, child protection. But if you do know who the child is or you know who the parent is, then you could make a call to, like, the Child Protective Services, the child welfare, if you thought that it was, you know, reaching the level of abuse. And then they would have to investigate the family to see, you know, is there abuse taking place? So, like, in our country... and I'm sure it's similar in yours, but educators and people that work with children are typically mandated reporters. So if they even suspect abuse is taking place, it has to be reported. And then once it's reported to social services, it's investigated. So, but if you ever see a child who's in imminent danger and harm, I mean, really at least here where we live, the only thing you could do is call 911, but you could also intervene if it seems... You never want to put yourself in harm's way, but if it seems like you have to use your discernment to decide, like, does this person seem like I can approach them and will they receive this from me right now? Sometimes it's helpful to interrupt and just say, like, you know, I can see you're having a really hard time here. Is there anything I can do to help? And as long as they're not feeling judged, I think it can work. I think it's just, you know, sometimes well-meaning people can come off as feeling, you know, oh, you're judging my parenting. You know, I'm struggling here. And it can feel, especially in public, very uncomfortable for a parent who's struggling with a child. But I think if you feel safe and you feel as though you can intervene, it's really about being non-judgmental and being able to say, hey, I can see you guys are having a tough time here. Is there anything I can do to help, or, you know, is there something I can do? And try to de-escalate the situation as much as possible.
Yep. Okay. No, that's a perfect answer. And I hope that is exactly the advice that when I'm thinking about that situation, I like you, I don't know what I would do in that moment, whether it would be the moment I'm brave enough to sort of like stand up for it, or whether I just sort of secretly is just sort of watch them and maybe call the police or something like that. So that's why I was like, that's always a qualm that I have when I sort of, once in a blue moon where I see a situation like that happening, I don't know what I would, I still don't know what I will do or what I would do.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's always a societal qualm where you don't want to sort of interrupt a parent sort of parenting their child, but you also maybe like, okay, is that a bit too much? Is that yanking them a bit too much of a hold that she have on them? So there's always that tricky thing when it comes to not wanting to sort of be a part of that situation if you don't need to be.
Yeah, no, it is. It's very tricky. And I'm fortunate I've never been in that situation, but I can imagine it'd be a hard decision to make. And, you know, you have to consider your own safety too. And yeah, I think sometimes the best thing might be to maybe even get the help of a manager, like say if you're in a store or in the mall or somewhere where there's other people around who might have some, not authority, but like some, you know, influence over the situation. Maybe it's best even to go to someone like that and say, hey, there's an issue going on over here. You know, what should we do? Mm-hmm. And kind of get other people to help as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's even better advice as well, sort of involving someone a little bit higher up, which is, I think that's even greater.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to the role that a lot of people must play, what is a role that family members should play in safeguarding children from domestic violence? And I know that you mentioned that a little bit earlier, but just as a direct sort of approach, what should a lot of family members do if they sort of want to protect their children from domestic violence?
Well, you know, typically it's really difficult to protect your child from domestic violence if you are involved with or married to someone who is a perpetrator and someone who's abusing other people. In that case, you have to get away. You have to get away from them, and your child's and yourselves, your own safety has to be of the utmost importance. I think that that's not always easy to do, and there's lots of reasons why. There's things like trauma bonding that takes place between people who are being abused and their abuser, where they actually there's a bond that happens between them because of the trauma, and that can be really difficult to break through. And so I think one of the things that we can do is teaching our children about healthy relationships versus unhealthy relationships from an early on standpoint. Like early on in life, we need to be examples and showing them examples of healthy relationships, two-way relationships, not one-sided relationships, and safe people, and involving them around safe people, and teaching them what kind of red flags to look out for, you know, especially for teens who are starting to date and get involved with other people. It's important to help develop their sense of, okay, this is a red flag versus, you know, this is an okay behavior. You know, you need to help them develop their own ability to recognize abusive qualities in other people. And I think that can be a way. And even then, sometimes these people that abuse are so manipulative and so good at what they do that even if you've prepared your child, you still can't prevent it from happening. So while you can do as much as you possibly can, sometimes even though you've done all the right things, the wrong thing can still happen, or the harmful thing can still happen. And then it's about being a support and helping them get safe. Mm-hmm. And not involve, if you're a parent and you want to protect your child from abusive situations, you need to not be in relationship with people who are harmful to you or your child. So that can be a challenge if it runs in your family and it's kind of like what you're used to. And I think that's an important piece of this too, is that these patterns are passed down through family from generation to generation. And if it was the norm in your house growing up, it kind of, you know, becomes the norm for your own family down the road. And so interrupting those patterns are really important.
Mm-hmm. I saw this show on Netflix a little while ago called, I think it was called The Maid, sort of dealing with, it was a mom who was dealing with a domestic violence situation, and she sort of had to run and escape and leave with her daughter and sort of go to a domestic violence shelter, sort of protection space. And there's a, and sort of build her life up. And I was talking about it, and I was watching this with my mom as well. We were sort of discussing it a little bit, and you could sort of see her mom, the character in her mom, sort of being a similar situation and sort of going from a partner to partner and sort of jumping. So when I was watching that, when we were talking about that, it sort of reminded me of that show a little bit, where it sort of does sort of run in the family, sort of what they're used to and what you sort of expect in a relationship. And trying to get out of that is probably one of the most difficult things for her to learn to do.
Yes, absolutely. You definitely hit the nail on the head there. I think that, you know, for our brains, what's familiar is what feels comfortable to us, and things that are unfamiliar feel uncomfortable to us. And if you grew up in a very volatile family with a lot of chaos and a lot of fighting and a lot of abuse, to be in a calm, stable, loving family is going to feel very foreign and different to you. And anything that signals as different to a child or a person in general feels threatening, feels uncomfortable, feels stressful. You also may crave the same level of constant stimulation too. If you are a family that was very chaotic and a lot of abuse happening, to be in a very gentle family might feel almost boring or like undesirable in a way. And not consciously, you wouldn't say, oh, I'm so bored of this gentle, loving family, right? But unconsciously, subconsciously, you might feel very like, this doesn't feel right to me. This, I don't like this. And you could be craving more drama, more chaos, because your brain has sort of been used to it. It's been used to it for so long that you're looking to sort of recreate the same patterns that you went through in your own family. And then there's also just like the behavior that gets passed down. Like if you watched your parents abuse you, like that's learned behavior. You learned that that's what you do as a parent and that's your norm. So you can easily become triggered as a parent and start reacting in the same way as your parents did and harm your own child, because it's just like once you're in that, you know, response of feeling overwhelmed and you don't know what to do and you're angry, you know, that anger can turn into harm if you don't slow down and sort of interrupt that pattern. So I give all the credit to people who are able to break out of that cycle. And there's a great new book out by a colleague of mine called her name is Dr. Mariel Bouquet, and it's called Break the Cycle. And it's a book for adults on how to break the cycle of intergenerational trauma. Another book that I'm currently reading besides The Glass Castle. And I recommend it to any of your listeners to check that out. But yeah, it's a huge problem that we see in families where this trauma is being, you know, recycled and passed down from family to family. Yeah.
No, that's, thank you for sharing that. And also thank you for sharing a new book that I'm going to list down in the links below in order for everyone to find it. Cause I think it's such a big issue sort of dealing with generational trauma. And I mentioned this so much on the show because I think it's something that we neglect to talk about in such a normal and natural space. We have like certain courses for it, but it's only for certain people who know about it rather than just sort of making this accessible information for everyone in a normal conversation to sort of go through. And yeah, so that's my big advocacy, is sort of going through like talking about intergenerational trauma, because I think it's such a big issue for a lot of people who don't know about it to really look into it. Even if you think that you don't have any trauma sort of connected to you, there's always some underlying trauma that's always there, which is also really interesting, an interesting sort of study to look into.
Yes, it's fascinating. I mean, they do find even biological changes in the children of people from the Holocaust and from 9/11, where epigenetically their makeup has been altered because of this trauma, even though they didn't live through it. So like they have done research on babies in the, you know, who were in the womb during 9/11, and those babies are showing different markers on their genes for the trauma they endured. And it's fascinating and also just eye-opening, and also, you know, sad in a lot of ways too, that we have ignored for so long this trauma that gets passed down. But I think the hopeful news is that our relationships can heal that, and we can, you know, as I see a quote online a lot that says, like, just as though intergenerational trauma can be passed down, so can intergenerational healing and resilience, and all those things can also be passed down. So we need to look at, you know, both sides, both the good things that we've received from our ancestors, as well as, you know, some of the not so good things or terrible things, and give weight to both of those, because, you know, we wouldn't be here if it weren't for our ancestors' resiliency, right? They had to overcome so exactly. much. And so some of that is living in us along with the trauma. I think that that message gives people hope.
Yes, no, I agree. I think sort of looking into that is also something that always fascinates me, sort of looking at the positives and negatives of us sort of learning from what previous generations did, I think is also really important.
Yeah.
Now, this leads us perfectly well into the next section of our show, which is called the practice and habit part. So this deals with some of your own practices or some practices that you would recommend families do, especially dealing with this situation. Uh-huh. So what is a practice that you would suggest to support and enhance the mental well-being of children, not just sort of in domestic violence situations, but sort of on a day-to-day life that sort of allows a child to be a child?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my favorite recommendations that goes along with what you said, it's like good for all children, not just children who have been in domestic violence situations. I'll kind of talk about two things. But my first suggestion, and it sounds super simple and almost like too much common sense, but it's highly effective and works and makes progress for so many families, is to spend special time together every day in a very structured way that is predictable and consistent. So for example, every day with my child, I make sure that we spend 10 minutes together doing something that she enjoys, that's her choice of activity, where I just am with her, am fully present. I put my phone in a drawer. You know, I tell my husband it's special time, like don't interrupt us. And he does it with her too. It's not just me, but both of us do this ritual with her. And she gets our undivided full attention for 10 minutes every day. And she knows it's going to happen. So she's not feeling anxious about when is she going to get my attention again. She knows it's going to happen every day for at least 10 minutes. So that kind of takes the edge off of our kids a little bit when they're constantly fighting for our attention. Because let's be honest, how often do any of us sit down really fully undistracted to interact with one another? Even when we're at, you know, even when we make plans to go out with our friends for dinner, we have our phone sitting next to us and we're texting somebody while we're sitting at the dinner table with our friends. Like it's just so much now part of our lives to be in two places at once that and children don't operate like that. Like children, they need to have our full presence and our sense of attention and caregiving in order to feel seen and heard. And so few people realize the lack of attention that we're giving our kiddos. And it's not because we don't love them or not because we don't care, because trust me, I do this myself. I find myself like typing on my phone as she's asking me questions over and over. Mommy, did you do this? Mommy, mommy, mommy. And I'm like, oh crap, I'm doing it again. You know, I'm not paying attention to her. And now, of course, we can't pay attention all the time, but we do need to make an effort to have this consistent, expected, predictable time together where there are no interruptions, there are no competing distractions, and where they can count on us to fully have our attention. And so we do that for 10 minutes each day. Each parent chooses a different time. It's important to do it when the child is not in a rush or like stressed out about something where you're like trying to get somewhere quickly, or, you know, it's best to do it maybe somewhere after school, but not, you know, not during a stressful time of day. And you don't want to do it at bedtime because oftentimes you're just too tired and it's easy to get frustrated. Some of the ground rules to it are to keep, you know, phones cannot be around for anyone, put them in a drawer, put them somewhere out of reach and out of mind. It's also important to not get engaged in any sort of directive, like corrections for the child. So you wouldn't want to play like a competitive game or do any type of roughhousing during this time, because you would eventually have to get into like a correcting place. And so the idea of this interaction is to be completely positive. You shouldn't have to correct the child during this time unless it's a safety issue. And if there are little things that come up that are frustrating or annoying, it's best to just kind of, you know, let them go and until the 10 minutes is over, and then if you need to address something. But just having that structured time and giving them your full attention can be incredibly powerful. And I always recommend it to my clients, as well as I practice it in my own family. And I do find that it makes a difference, mostly because I think it's her knowing that she's going to get it helps lower her anxiety. And it's helpful overall. Now, for children who are experiencing domestic violence, the reason that helps is because you're building trust with the child, right? So that trust and safety is what's been ripped away from them. And when you are in connection and you're fully present with a child, giving them your time and attention, that helps to rebuild their trust that you are safe and that they are safe. Even if it's just for this 10 minutes a day, you're giving them time to feel safe and watched and loved. And that's something they may not have. So yeah, it's a good practice no matter what your situation is. And for children who are in domestic violence situations, anything you can do to help them feel safe is going to be beneficial. So whether that's being completely honest with them as much as you can about things that are coming up or changes, even like going over the day and the routines with children to say, okay, you know, this morning we're going to do this. At lunchtime, we're doing this. In between lunch and dinner, we're doing this. And then at dinner, we're doing this. And then at bedtime, we're doing this. And I know it sounds like a lot, but for them, it just helps them know what's coming next. And that's so important for them when they've had so much unpredictability in the past and so little control over their situation. That sense of knowing what's coming next can be incredibly grounding for them and reduce their anxiety. And then, of course, preparing them if there are changes as soon as possible. So one of the things that really can set children off into their trauma responses are unexpected changes or unexpected transitions that they, you know, weren't expecting. So you want to, if there is a change coming, because life happens, right? Not everything can be predictable, especially with children and families. But you want to try and give them as much notice as you can, meaning not like a week's notice, because that'll just give them too much time to worry about it. But if you can give them a day or two notice that some change is happening in their schedule or in their caretaking, things like that, it can help buffer some of the response that they might have to it. But if you just try to like rip the Band-Aid off and, you know, surprise a kid because you think that's better for them, that typically doesn't help or doesn't work. It's actually better to give them some time to process what is coming, but not too much time to start ruminating and getting really anxious about it.
I can definitely see that.
Concrete things. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see that. It's both two advice, little practices. They seem simple. They seem like a little insert day to day. I love the 10 minutes of individual parent time rather than just both parents together and sitting with the child. Just individual, I think, is really nice because it develops their relationship individually, which sounds a lot more important than sort of dealing with it together. Mm-hmm. And no, I love that. I love that approach. I think also the whole schedule, I have deep anxiety myself. There's no way that I can't not know what's going on in the day. So I definitely can see how that would be beneficial for a lot of children sort of dealing with the trauma from a lot of different issues sort of going on in their head. I mean, there are 10,000 different voices that are going on in my head. So imagining the schedule, sort of knowing exactly where they're going to be, exactly what time, or at least sort of the hours that they're going to be there for, I think is deeply important and allows them to sort of be a little bit more engaged at that and a bit more present as well, which I think is a lot more beneficial.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And there's, you know, I could give 10 more other examples, but it's, you know, it's only an hour long show. So, but those are some of my initial, you know, go-to things, just to setting up that foundation of trust. Like, we're always asking, can I trust you and can I trust the world? We're always asking ourselves that subconsciously. Can I trust this person? Can I trust the world? And if the answer is no, you're going to have some trauma responses around those people and in the world. So we want to be answering the question for the child is, yes, you can trust me. Yes, the world is safe. And yes, you can trust me. And we do that by being consistent, caring, validating, and honest with children, even when it's hard.
Mm-hmm. No, and thank you so much for that advice. I think a lot of people are going to try to, I hope a lot of people are learning from that, because I think that's such a great practice to sort of put in, even just in your own family as well, just sort of adding those little things here and there to sort of allow children to calm their own anxieties down, which I know anxiety is a big thing in a lot of children, especially in today's world, we talk about it a lot more. So I think those two pieces of advice, I think, are perfect for calming a lot of anxieties down.
Yeah. Thank you.
So we're going to be leading into the last section of our show, which is the open mic. This sort of allows you to share anything that you are passionate about, or maybe something that you want to promote on our show today. So in the last minute or so, I'd love to give you the floor and share what you have on your mind for today.
Yeah, absolutely. I so appreciate the opportunity to be here, first of all, and thank you for your kindness and your questions, and getting this information out to families is my deepest passion. You know, making sure I get, you know, some of the helpful things that I've learned through my training and experience as a therapist into the hands of the parents and the caregivers, the teachers who are spending the most time with them, so that we can improve safety and well-being for our children. You know, that's, you know, trauma, childhood trauma is often the root cause of so many of our social problems. And if we can prevent and help to heal some of it, we're making progress to a better future for all of us. So that's my, you know, my biggest passion is getting that out, that information out there. And the way I do that is, one, I have a free monthly newsletter that you can subscribe to on my website at bethtyson.com. And each month I pick a different topic and I sort of deep dive into, you know, ways to help children cope or heal with whatever it is that month that we're talking about. And I share lots of free resources and events that come up for children and families who have experienced trauma and loss. And then I also have two children's books. One children's book is called A Grand Family for Sullivan, and it's available on Amazon. And it's for any relative or grandparent, aunt, uncle who's raising a child for someone else, you know, because of very unfortunate circumstances. And it helps the child and the adult find ways to cope with the loss and the trauma they're going through. And then my second children's book isn't out yet, but it should be out in the next 2 months or so, also on Amazon. It'll be called Sullivan Goes to See Mama. And it's a sequel to the first book, but it stands alone as well. You can read it independently. Like, you don't have to read one to read the other. And this is a book for children who have to go to supervised visitation, which often happens when there's domestic violence in the family. So if a child or a parent if a parent is unsafe to be caring for a child on their own, but still has parental rights and still wants to see and be involved in the child's life, often the court will mandate supervised visitation, which means that the child can see the parent, but it's within certain rules and in certain environments. So they might have to go to a visitation center to spend time with that person. And this can all be very traumatizing and hard and distressing for a child. So I wrote a children's book to help those kiddos cope with the experience of being in a supervised visitation and what they might feel, what they might go through, and then what they can do to cope with it. And that will be out, like I said, in a couple of months. But the best way to stay in touch with me is by visiting bethtyson.com. You can subscribe to the newsletter there, or you can also find me on social media. I have a big following on LinkedIn, and you just would search Beth Tyson for that. And I have quite a large following on Facebook as well, where I have both a Facebook page and a Facebook group, private group, where people can learn more about childhood trauma and trauma-informed care. And that's called Emotaminds. Yeah.
Oh, that's perfect. And yeah, no, that's fine. That's perfect. Thank you so much for sharing that. I'll definitely, if you want to send those links over to me, and then I can definitely add those down into the description to allow a lot of other viewers who are wanting to sort of be a part of that group or learn a little bit more about you, just have the space where they can go access that quickly. So yeah, that would be great.
And I also, so beyond that, like my biggest thing is really the training and the education. So I've been doing public speaking events and presentations and workshops for organizations. I don't work one-on-one with individuals, but I do provide training and education to organizations who need trauma-informed strategies and are passionate about children's mental health and improving children's mental health. So feel free to reach out to me on my website, and that's bethtyson.com.
Perfect. I'll definitely have that down in the link below as well.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Beth, for coming on the show today and for sharing a lot of your advice and a lot of your expertise on such a really big issue that I think a lot of it's coming to light in this day and age. So I'm really glad that we are able to sort of talk about it today and sort of normalize the conversations that we don't really normalize in a lot of society.
It's so true. I'm so glad that you were brave to have this discussion and to bring this topic to a wider audience. And this is, you know, the work that we need to do in order to make change. So thank you.
And I hope you guys learned just as much as I did when it comes to these situations, and also how to be a participant bystander rather than just sort of overlook a lot of the issues that are going on. And I hope you guys learned as much as I did. So I'll see you all in the next episode that we have.
You've been listening to Altogether, the Family Science Insights podcast, produced by the Family Science Labs, a division of LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. More episodes are available from 10 life management perspectives and can be found by searching LMSL on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and other podcasting apps available on your devices. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating our show, sharing it, and subscribing to our channel, as it helps other people find it so that we can grow and bring you more quality resources. More of our work can be found on our website at fa.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Dina Sargent. Thanks for tuning in.